Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. As of April, 89% of food items in Malaysia had increased in price. Now, food inflation is up 4.1% from the previous year, and this is the highest jump since January of 2018. Now, while we are not the only country to be seeing a surge in food prices, is the situation at home also a reflection of poor planning around food security policies? Let's ask our guest tonight, Professor Datin Paduka Fatima Arshad. She is a fellow at the Laboratory of Agricultural and Food Policy Studies at UPM. She's also a senior fellow at the think tank Ideas. Professor Fatima, we understand that this problem might be global in nature, but is there something about Malaysia's food security policies that might underscore what's happening at home?
Thank you for inviting me. I think we can't discuss this issue without looking at the global situation, right? Some writers say this is a 3C shock, meaning there are three elements there: COVID-19, all right, and then the conflict, Russia and Ukraine, and of course climate change. Price variation is a norm in any commodity market. You take any commodity, you can see the variability of prices over the years, and this is a norm for all sorts of commodities, including fuel or food or any other items, right? So before this crisis, I must mention this. The trend has been on the rise because of three major factors, which most people are not aware of. One is the increase in demand for biofuel, and this has led to increased demand for corn as well as palm. Number two, they call it meatification. That means the demand for beef has gone up, right? And beef requires, I think, about 8 kg calorie to produce 1 kg calorie of beef. So more beef from countries that are doing well, say, for example, China and some developing countries has expanded the area for corn as well as demand. And don't forget about commodification of agricultural produce. And these are the factors that has led to uptrending price of commodities. Then came COVID. Then came the war, the Russian and Ukraine war. And we have seen climate change is no longer an illusion, no longer a nightmare, a scientist's nightmare, but they are real. So the combination of three C's are very lethal, and we have seen how it has affected the world. I'm not so sure how much the increase in price is due to three factors, as well as I heard some speculators are coming in, or some supply chain operators are also taking advantage, but let things the way they do. But overall, prices have increased, and the effect are tremendous, are damaging. One, multi-commodity effect. Food commodities, industrial raw materials, platinum, fuel, and also water because of the climate change. So the whole world is suffering now. And Malaysia, being a net food importer, is also affected. All right. So going back to Melissa's question, I agree with you, Melissa. The problem that we are facing is also out of our own doing, meaning we have not produced enough food to cushion or to dampen the inflationary effect on our food industry. So we are partly to be blamed. I mean, if you look at the statistic, for example, we are dependent on import on two major products. Food output, for example, meat, beef, mutton, even vegetables, even fruits, yeah. And number two, we input almost 95% of our input factor. You name it, we depend on imports. Seeds, breeds for livestock, feed for livestock, corn, soybean, any other cereals, machines, pesticide, weedicide, herbicide, fertilizer. And lastly but not least, labor. So everything else we imported, right? That is why we, compared to other countries like Vietnam or Thai, we fail to create competitive advantage. We do have the comparative advantage, the natural advantage that we have lots of land, we have lots of, you know, we are number two, I always say this, we are number two in the world with regards to biodiversity. We talk about food, we talk about fruits, we talk about vegetables, we have all sorts of vegetables, and yet we import them. I still remember
Professor Fatima, if you could help us understand the why of it. I mean, you work at an institution that used to be called University Pattayanan, is now called University Putra. We have a situation in Perak where a very fertile patch of vegetable farming is threatened by, you know, by government there that wants to pour cement on an area that's producing 60 tons of vegetables in favor of residential housing and a high-tech park. Is it government values, government orientation that has led us to the situation of dependency on imports and, in fact, you know, undermining our own capacity to produce food?
Thank you, Shirat, for saying it for me. All right. We have been all this while. In fact, when we went for oil palm, for that matter, or rubber, of course they give a, you know, multiplier effect, but they are driven by profit. You know, we have these big estates with large plantation for oil palm, rubber, and so on, but by doing that, these are detected by our colonial masters. You know, their policy is about extracting as much as we can from our resources. Of course, it does give some economic benefit through multiplier effect. But along the way, we can see that because of the focus, heavy focus investment on oil palm, rubber, but cocoa has more or less almost wiped out. We have forgotten our strength in food. And if you look at the self-sufficiency level for all produce or food produce have all gone down from 2019 to 2020. None. I remember in 2011 was the turning point for fisheries product, particularly for marine fish. We were the net exporter, but 2011, it was a turning point for us. We are the net importer of marine fish. That's why the Thais are fishing in our water. They bring back the fish to Thai and then re-export to us, right? So we are eating, we are importing fish from our own waters.
Right. But Professor Fatima, is food security an issue that requires only long-term planning, and the effects can only be seen in the long term? I'm asking because this crisis seems to be hitting us hard right now, and I'm wondering, are there short-term measures that can be done to change our food security policy in addition to perhaps changing some of the more long-term policies?
Even what we call instant noodles, you have to cook, Melissa. You have to cook. Wait until the water is boiled, and then you can eat. You can only eat, right? So food is not like any other products. It takes time for them to grow, and it can't guarantee that it will grow well as well. So it takes time. So except for certain products such as cereals, you can keep them, you can store them, but still you have to cook them, right? You have to cook them and process them to become food. So talking about food security, I think this pandemic and this crisis have shown you know, the importance of food is equivalent to the air that we breathe, right? The FAO and United Nations are forecasting 851 million of people will suffer, will go into famine if the current situation continues. So it is going to be bad. It's going to be bad.
Fatima, you can help us and very quickly identify other areas in terms of infrastructure. You talk about grains and granaries, but there was also this expose of our cold rooms that where fish are landed in the country that were just not working, non-functioning cold rooms that could store up to 1,000 tons of fish. What's happened to that infrastructure? Is it neglect, incompetence? What's happening there?
Which cold room was it, Sharad?
It was with the fisheries department. There was a report about it. to explain why we didn't have stocks of frozen fish.
Yeah, it sounds very Malaysian, doesn't it? We have cold rooms and underutilized. I'm aware of there is one cold room in Puchong. It belongs to one GLC, and the utilization rate is only 10%. So, you know, when government is involved in business, it becomes inefficient because they know the money is plenty and there's no urgency. You know, urgency to be efficient, to ensure that profit is maximized and so on, because it's public money. So that is one of the reason, I think.
Right. Okay, so when we think about food security, there are so many levels to it. You think about land use at a state level. You think about the agriculture ministry playing a role. You think about the consumer ministry. How do we ensure that it's all kind of working together, talking together? It feels like we're not quite sure who to take responsibility, take accountability for the situation that we're in.
Thank you, Melissa. We have 70 ministries, correct? I rest my case. But in the US, they have only one ministry for agriculture that handles everything. So I'll give you an example. We have a Ministry of Plantation and Ministry of Commodity and Plantation, which only takes charge of oil palm and rubber and cocoa and timber. And we have Ministry of Agriculture and Food Industry, MAFI. And they forget that they share the same resources, land, labor, water, and even the seas, right? By right, they should think as one, how our policy will affect you and how your policy will affect mine, so that we work for agriculture and food for this country. But so far, because we think that oil palm is a golden crop, a rubber is golden crop, we don't care about food. We don't even care what are the implications of expanding 5.9 million hectares of oil palm on food. We don't even care of encouraging the estates to do mixed cropping by having livestock on their farms or by planting food on their farms when they could. But they are all profit-oriented, profit-oriented firms. So, and they're doing well now, because prices are more than 4K a ton, right? So you know what I mean? So there is no concern for the country. So they are more concerned of their survival in terms of profit. But if they are together, if the two heads sit down together and think about how our resources mobilized to achieve good agricultural or sustainable food for the whole country, it will be a different thing altogether. So,
Sorry, we've run out of time. And I want to thank you for being on the show. That was agriculture policy analyst, Professor Datin Paduka Fatima Arshad. We're going to take a quick break here and consider this. We will be back with more. Stay tuned. Thanks so much for staying with Shraddha and I on Consider This. We're discussing the surge in food prices and whether it's a reflection of Malaysia's poor planning around food security policies. Joining us now is economist Jomo Kwame Sundram. He's formerly the Assistant Director General at the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. Jomo, this problem seems to have a global nature. There are external factors that are contributing to the surge in food prices that we're seeing. But I'm wondering whether there are also internal factors, whether there are domestic factors that we could have anticipated or perhaps mitigated some of the impact that we're seeing from global forces.
Well, I think it is important to recognize the international factors as well. because much of the current inflation which we experience in the world has been largely driven by international factors, and most importantly in the recent period has been the war in Ukraine. And the responses to the war in Ukraine, particularly the unilateral sanctions imposed particularly by the US and its NATO allies against Russia, also affecting Belarus to some extent. And this has had a tremendous effect on prices, food prices. About a third of wheat exports in the world are from Russia and Ukraine, and both have been very severely disrupted. It's not so important for us here in Southeast Asia, but insofar as people, particularly in Africa, North Africa, West Asia, have been very much affected by this, inevitably wheat has to go there. The second factor, which has been extremely important, of course, has been the bad season, bad planting season in India. And this has led the government of India to stop its wheat exports. I'm also very concerned about some of the medium-term impacts because Russia and Ukraine, but especially Russia and Belarus, are major sources of fertilizers. And by removing a significant source of fertilizers, you're not only threatening food security in the short term, you're also having some medium and long-term impacts. Now, insofar as carbohydrates or calories are substitutable, and wheat has generally been considered the cheapest source of calories for some time, you find countries which were previously importing wheat and exporting rice doing less of that. And again, you have in recent period in places like Bangladesh and Vietnam, which is a significant exporter of rice to Malaysia, we find that the rising sea levels have affected production. In Malaysia as well, in the last 5 years, from 2016, in the 5 years from 2016, two planting seasons were cancelled in the Muda irrigation area, which basically means a heavier dependence on imports, which are of course, which were of course relatively cheaper to begin with, but now causes a lot of problems because prices have also gone up. So there's also been a great deal of speculation. So even before the war, prices, international prices were going up. Now, the actual relationship to, for example, the chicken feed for chicken is quite complicated. Much of the chicken feed is imported actually from places like the US, and this will obviously affect the price of chicken. And just by keeping the price, the selling price of chicken fixed, it's not going to do the trick because the farmers are paying much more for chicken. So if they substitute the usual chicken feed with other sources of nutrition, the chicken is going to come out much lighter, much smaller, and this is going to have implications. There are, of course, many other reasons as well. The domestic reasons are many, but relatively speaking, the government has not been, central bank has not been too anxious to join the bandwagon to try to raise interest rates, which would also which would also have some adverse impacts. So what could the Malaysian government have done? It's difficult to tell, but I think the current solution as far as chicken may not hold for very long because, for reasons which are probably quite obvious to you and to listeners. But there are also other prices which are generally affected by the general surge in prices. So for example, my favorite tempeh costs much more, I still haven't quite worked out the causation for that. I was very, very upset when my when my favorite makci who supplies me with tempeh was charging me far more. And I asked her, and she actually told me that, you know, what the price of tempeh was to her.
Yeah, Jomo, I wonder if you can I ask you about whether it's all about prices. You know, when we talk about food security, there are issues for a nation to consider in terms of vulnerability, whether it's dependent on a single source, and whether it's diversified its sourcing of food, and the balance between imports and domestic production. Why has Malaysia, do you think, led itself down this path where it seems to be unnecessarily vulnerable, considering the capacity that we have, the land that we have, to actually produce much more and secure, as it were, for the population, food?
Well, the fact of the matter is that Malaysians, by and large, have been encouraged to practice agriculture, which is most remunerative. And this basically means cash crops, and cash crops rarely mean food. Okay, and this has been the unfortunate case for decades. Now, during the colonial period, the British, to try to save on foreign exchange going outside of the sterling zone, the British basically encouraged some rice growing, especially in Tanjung Karang area, in Selangor, and in Perak, in Krian. They didn't do very much for Kedah and Kelantan, where there was also quite a bit of rice being grown. The reason being that the rice, that those were unfederated Malay states and under less direct British influence. So the result of all this, of course, has been that we have, for a long time, for far, far too long, we have equated food security with rice production. And there has been some popular support for it because, of course, during the Japanese occupation for the older generation, they had to eat tapioca and things like that, which were not only less nutritious, quite problematic to consume because of certain requirements in treating tapioca, but also, very importantly, they were lacking in certain minerals and vitamins, which resulted in a great deal of hardship, vitamin deprivation among the Malaysian population.
Right. Jomo, can I ask you? I mean, there seems to be structural issues with the policy, Malaysia's food security policies. Things that perhaps hoping we can use this as an opportunity to address, but that as you mentioned a bit earlier, the short-term solutions will not hold for long. What do you think can be done by government in the short term to help, you know, mitigate some of the impact that we're seeing with the surge in food prices, particularly?
I think the most important challenge would be to consider options which are serious options for the present period, rather than to approach the whole problem from the perspective of about, you know, arguably over half a century ago. The jihad memerangi orang tengah, for example, was inspired by an analysis from the late 50s, early 60s, which might have been quite relevant then. But conditions have changed a great deal since then. And that elimination of the so-called middleman basically resulted in the strengthening of the role in the case of rice, of Bernas. For example, in Kelantan, the 21 existing perai were basically largely eliminated by this jihad. Now, the whole analysis at that time was also partially ethnic. But today, the whole ethnic profile of the division of labor has changed very significantly. But more importantly, besides marketing, it ignores problems of credit, it ignores problems of the possibility of alternative modes of production. There's a significant agroecological movement all over the world, for example, which is able to produce rice as well as rotate rice production with other production, and much more ecologically sound, much more sustainable practices. But many of these things have not really been considered. And researchers, there are many agricultural researchers, but the incentives for them are to publish in international journals, and it doesn't matter whether it is relevant to Malaysian needs. So much of the expertise which we have in Malaysia has been lost over the years. I still remember meeting a plant breeder from Mardi, who said he was going to retire in a couple of years at that time, about 5 years ago, and that there was nobody who was going to replace him. There wasn't going to be a single plant breeder. I've also heard of others who have, after some disenchantment working here, moved to Indonesia, and they have become very successful in Indonesia. So a great deal of the innovation, for example, in oil palm, the dwarf oil palm trees, which are going to ensure a much more sustained productivity of oil palm over the life of the trees, is going to be, you know, is widespread in Indonesia, but less widespread here, and a whole range of other examples. You know, if we get into all that, but right. I think it's important to distinguish between agriculture generally and food agriculture, and the incentives to improve the food for Malaysians is not there. We also find that a lot of vegetables, for example, which are using toxic herbicides, are actually being there's no incentive to get the farmers to use less of these herbicides. The only time we hear about it is when those vegetables are rejected by a neighboring country down south.
Jomo, thank you so much for helping shed light on this very important issue. Appreciate your time, Professor Jomo Kwame Sundram, wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Agus.
And I'm Sharad Kutton, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching.
Good night.